Hello, this is Terrence McNally. This week I'm going to share with you a couple of my favorite previously recorded interviews, both dealing with system thinking, one of the ingredients I suspect of a world that just might work. In the first half hour, I'll speak with Krzysztof Capra, author of many books, including 2014's The Systems View of Life. This interview with Capra originally aired in January 2008. In the second half, my guest will be Nora Bateson, director of the documentary An Ecology of Mind, about her father, the late Gregory Bateson.
I'm going to read a rather long quote to lead into today's conversation, so bear with me, if you will. Here's the quote. I have come to believe that today, our society as a whole finds itself in a crisis. We can read about its numerous manifestations every day in the newspaper. We have high inflation and unemployment. We have an energy crisis, a crisis in health care, pollution and other environmental disasters, a rising wave of violence and crime, and so on. The basic thesis of the book he was writing is that these are all different facets of one and the same crisis, and that this crisis is essentially a crisis of perception. It derives from the fact that we are trying to apply the concepts of an outdated worldview, the mechanistic worldview of Cartesian, Newtonian science, to a reality that can no longer be understood in terms of these concepts. We live today in a globally interconnected world in which biological, psychological, social, and environmental phenomena are all interdependent. To describe this world appropriately, we need an ecological perspective, which the Cartesian worldview does not offer. What we need, then, is a new paradigm, a new vision of reality, a fundamental change in our thoughts, perceptions, and values. Now, any of you who listen to the show on a regular basis know I agree with that quote. Now, first of all, those are the words of today's guest, Krzysztof Capra. But the amazing thing is that they were written in 1981 in the preface to his book, The Turning Point. The Turning Point, I believe, is a remarkable book. I've read it more than once, and I've given it as a present several times. And we'll talk today about the power of worldviews and why so little has changed in 27 years. Krzysztof Capra has a new book out, The Science of Leonardo, and we'll talk about that as well. He says that most authors who have discussed the science of Leonardo da Vinci, the great master painter and genius of the Renaissance, have examined it through a Newtonian lens. And according to him, this has prevented them from understanding its essential nature, which he believes is radically different from the mechanistic science of those other giants, Galileo, Descartes, and Newton. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Krzysztof Capra is a founding director of the Center for Ecoliteracy in Berkeley, California, which promotes ecology and systems thinking in primary and secondary education. He's on the faculty of Schumacher College, an international center for ecological studies in England, and he's the author of several bestsellers, including The Tao of Physics and The Turning Point. He also co-authored Green Politics and co-edited Steering Business Towards Sustainability. And his most recent book is the one that's just out, The Science of Leonardo. Welcome, Krzysztof Capra, to KPFK and Free
Hello, Forum. Terry. Yeah, thank you for having me on your show. As you know, I live in Berkeley, and I've been on KPFA numerous times, but I've never been down here in KPFK, and I'm very happy to finally do an interview here.
Another turning point.
Right.
No, it's great to have you. As I think I said before we went on air, I've obviously, that book came out in 81, and as I said, I've read it more than once and actually have given. It's a rather thick book, but I've given it to people and said, here, this says a lot of what needs to be said, and have followed your thinking over the years. So it's really my pleasure as well when I saw you were going to be in town. And, you know, grab the chance to have you on. So one thing, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work when we start off. So let me ask you, how did a mild-mannered physicist become the author of books about worldviews and paradigm change?
Well, it all began with my interest in philosophy. My father was a lawyer, but very well read and very interested in philosophy. And at home, we had a large library of philosophers. My mother was a poet. And both my parents were very interested in art and, you know, dragged my brother and me through all the museums in Italy when we were around 10 or 12. So when I became a scientist and studied physics in Vienna, Immediately, I was interested in the philosophy of science, and I was very influenced by a book by Werner Heisenberg, one of the founders of atomic physics, quantum physics. The book is called Physics and Philosophy, and it's now a classic. And Heisenberg describes in it how those physicists struggled with a new worldview that was emerging in physics, with experiments that were totally mysterious at first and led them into radically new concepts. And that book stayed with me through my studies. And then came the 60s. I got interested in Eastern philosophy. George Harrison went to India, brought back a sitar, you know, and all these things worked together. And so I also became interested in the social movements in the 60s. I was in Paris in May 68. I was in Berkeley shortly after that. And all that eventually, you know, is reflected in my books. But first I explored the sort of expansion of consciousness into the spiritual, the religious, the mystical, and that's the Tao of physics. And then I explored the expansion of consciousness into the social realm, the social, questioning authority in many, many fields, you know, the kind of work that is now institutionalized here at KPFK.
Exactly.
But which was radical and, you know, in living rooms and kitchens and grassroots movements in the 60s. And so in the turning point, I made this diagnosis, which you read, which I think, for better or worse, is still very valid, you know, in a sense, unfortunately. Now, the new paradigm, especially in science, but also in society, has progressed enormously. And I wrote a couple of books in between The Web of Life and The Hidden Connections, in which I really outline the systems view of life that is now rather complete, with a biological dimension, a cognitive dimension in the whole field of cognitive science, and a social dimension.
Let me cut you off for 1 second there, Fritjof Capra. When you said that in these intervening years, as you present in those later books, and they're The Web of Life and The Hidden Connections, right?
Right.
I've also read both of them. You say the systems view of life has now been more rounded out and filled out.
And formalized,
through actual discoveries and work, or just better articulation?
Well, both. But a lot of discoveries. A key development came in the late 70s and early 80s with complexity theory, which is technically known as nonlinear dynamics. Now we have a mathematical language to describe nonlinear systems. Now, you may ask, what are nonlinear systems? Basically, everything you're interested in. You know, living organisms are nonliving systems. The economy is a nonliving system. Society,
community. Wait, you said nonliving. You meant nonlinear.
Nonlinear, sorry.
Right.
The economy is a nonlinear, and they're all living systems, right?
Exactly.
And that's why they are nonlinear. And this connection between life and nonlinearity, mathematically, if you want to describe it mathematically, was the big breakthrough around 1980.
So, in other words, a couple of things I want to respond to that. One is that when you wrote the book, The Tao of Physics, and the book, The Turning Point, and you mentioned that you worked on The Turning Point for 6 years, so a lot of time you're working on that. This field hasn't really fleshed itself out yet.
You're writing
about something which calls for complexity theory before complexity theory has been articulated.
And I sort of cobbled together a chapter which I called The Systems View of Life. I sort of took things from all parts, but it's not a coherent theory. Now, 20 years later, I could write The Hidden Connections, where this synthesis that I'm now proposing is much more coherent and much more founded on actual science.
Okay, very good. The other thing I was going to say is, let's go to this question, and it's one of the big questions that I've been asking for many years, which is, I will state to people, preface, reality is not dead, mechanical, or separate. But reality is alive, evolving, and composed of interdependent systems.
Absolutely.
And when I've had Kenny Ausubel of the Bioneers, I say that's basically the premise of the Bioneers conferences, isn't it?
Right.
So I believe that such a worldview has been shared by indigenous peoples for millennia. It's been revealed by science since early in the 20th century. And now, not in its fullness, as you just pointed out. It's obvious to me every time you walk outside the door, look at the sky, look into the eyes of a living being. How do we explain the hypnotic hold of the mechanical worldview on people in power, let's say, or on the prevailing culture?
Well, I would guess it is through the connection between science and technology, because the mechanistic Newtonian science was the theoretical background of the Industrial Revolution, and it allowed people to design wonderful machines, from the steam engine on to, you know, the automobile. And, you know, most of the machines we are using now, today, actually require quantum theory to explain the physics that underlies.
I understand. And, in other words, driving a modern car, you're driving a computer on wheels, basically.
That's right, yeah. Driving a Prius, by the way, which is a great car.
Which we both drive, I assume. Yeah. Definitely, that one is a computer. You can't get that fixed elsewhere. Yeah. So what you're saying is that most of the machines that were the industrial age, and am I correct, most of the social systems that were the industrial age were based in that mechanical model.
That's right. You see, Newton's mechanics was the sort of model for everything, for all the sciences, and for many things where it's inappropriate, like medicine, for instance, or, you know, social science, economics, management. You know, a company is not a machine, and a community is not a machine. The human body is not a machine. But that was assumed, and people went quite far with it.
With God as the great clockmaker in
That's
the sky,
right?
So when I asked, how do you explain the hypnotic hold, in other words, that people still want to function that way, I think if one looks at even American politics, American foreign policy under Bush, there's a lot of hierarchy and mechanism.
Yes, and linear thinking. You know, in Newtonian science, in the mechanistic paradigm, if you want to explain something, and Descartes actually was the founder of this strategy. If you want to explain something, you reduce it to the smallest components, and you try with the mechanisms that interconnect them to explain the whole. You don't make connections to other wholes. Now, let's take ecology or biology as a whole as an example. If you go out in the forest and see a bird with red feathers, and you want to explain this scientifically, you don't decompose the feathers. That doesn't, you know, you can look at the pigments and that's one reason why they are red. But, you know, why did nature come up with red feathers? You have to relate the bird to its environment, to its habitat, to its history. That's ecological thinking and it's systemic thinking. You have to connect the dots, as we say in a popular parlance. And this is a singular lack in our politicians, not just Bush, but, you know, all our political or most of our political and corporate leaders do not know how to connect the dots. So they go to Iraq to fight a war that bleeds the country to get oil that we don't even need because we have other means of energy now. If we had spent a fraction of that money developing conservation,
I believe it's up to
alternative sources.
I believe it's up to $2 or $3 billion a week right now.
Yeah.
And had we spent, as you say, a fraction of what we spent in Iraq developing renewable energy, we'd have done a service to the whole world.
Yes, and we would have prevented this rise of global warming, of global climate change because of, you know, the greenhouse gases.
And you can bet oil wouldn't be costing $100 a barrel if suddenly it had competition.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or, you know, if we fed the children in our schools organically grown food, we wouldn't have the crisis of obesity, we wouldn't poison the farm workers, and again, the organically grown food in an organic soil needs a lot of carbon because carbon is the chemical backbone of life. And where do these worms and bacteria take the carbon from? Well, from the air. They draw it down. Therefore, a carbon sink, again, you know, fighting global climate change through organic food in our schools. Well, that's connecting the dots. That's systemic thinking.
That's right. That's reality is alive and interdependent. By the way, I've had Ann Cooper on. Are you familiar with her? She runs the nutrition program in the Berkeley School District,
which is
not only providing kids organic food, but teaching them about.
That's right. And at the Center for Ecoliteracy, we are very much involved in this.
I wanted to ask you about that. And so since you just brought it up, I will. What was it when it started? And what do you feel you've accomplished over the years? Because you've been there a long time.
Yeah, over 10 years, about 12 years. Well, its mission is to promote ecological thinking, the science of ecology and systemic thinking in schools.
And let me say to people, if you've been following this conversation, when he says ecology, he doesn't mean something about the environment. Ecology is about the interweaving of all of life.
Yes, and it includes, of course, the environment. Yeah. So we take kids out into gardens, into school gardens, and have them experience ecology with the hands in the earth, the change of the season, the cycle of growth and decay of plants. They cook meals in schools. They go out and visit farms. They go to farmers' markets. So it's a whole program like this, which has grown tremendously, and it's always linked to curriculum. So what they learn in the classroom refers to what they learn in the garden, and vice versa.
And if people want to learn more about that,
there's a link on my website to the Center for Ecoliteracy, and the website there is ecoliteracy.org.
Okay, ecoliteracy, one word, .org. Is some of that work available beyond Berkeley? Have you spread it to school
yes.
systems around the country?
Yes, because we are now teaching seminars, and people come from all over the country, and they do things in other schools. They actually come from all over the world. With the internet now, with our website, which is very extensive, we announce our seminars, and we get participants from Brazil, from Norway, from Australia. It's absolutely fantastic.
That's very exciting. Yeah. Let me ask a couple of other questions. Let me mention one other thing. We've talked about it generally. The thing that most struck me about the turning point, besides the worldview, was that you, as you sort of briefly did just there, there's a section in there where you look at how that old worldview sort of hinders us in various arenas and how a new worldview could help us.
Right.
And you look at health and medicine. You look at agriculture. You look at business and economics. You look at energy and environment. Two questions. One, first, could you just like maybe speak about agriculture, okay, just for a bit? Second, have you thought of updating that book? Because it seems to me that is the reason that I've given it as a gift is I say, here's how to look at the big picture.
Well, in a sense, The Hidden Connections, which was published in 2002, is the 21st century version of the turning point. You see, at the turning point, as you said, I looked at biology, I looked at medicine, I looked at economics, but in The Hidden Connections, I look at life.
Ah, okay.
Because that's what they have in common. And I integrate the biological dimensions of life with the cognitive dimensions and the social dimensions. And I again look at all these sciences, but from an integrative point of view. Now, the historical section is still very valid in the turning point. And there, my big new discovery is that this systemic thinking, this relating everything to life, this seeing the earth as alive, was really founded by Leonardo da Vinci. That's why he's so important.
Okay.
It's not only fascinating to study him as a Renaissance genius, but he's tremendously relevant for our time.
I'm Terry McNally. I'm speaking with Fritjof Capra. He's a best-selling author of several books, starting with The Tao of Physics, and his newest is The Science of Leonardo. Okay, so you say the discovery you made, and I'm going to ask you two questions again.
Right.
How did you happen to make that discovery? What led you back to look at Leonardo's science, and then what did it tell
you? Well, I had been fascinated by Leonardo since the 1970s when I wrote The Tao of Physics. I came across a statement that he wrote where he defines his empirical method, that he will observe nature and then draw conclusions and use reasoning to see why nature acts in a certain way. That's what we now call the scientific method. He also used mathematics. He also used theoretical models. And ever since that time, I thought he should really be interpreted from the point of view of our modern science of life, our complexity theory. And it took me 20, 30 years to get around to doing
it. Right. I think you even say that you have a quote from him early in the Tao of Physics, right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
And that's now the epitaph of the new book. Now what was the second part of
the question?
The
second question is, so what? How far ahead of his time was he in terms of his use of, if not his definition of, the scientific method?
Well, Leonardo lived 100 years before Galileo, and he single-handedly created this empirical approach that we now call the scientific method.
What were people doing prior to that?
Well, knowledge was transmitted from the Greek philosophers. Science did not exist, not even the word science in our sense. It was called natural philosophy. And those were speculations that were transmitted from philosopher to philosopher, were never checked empirically, and then in the Middle Ages were fused with Christian doctrine and used as the official creed. And any questioning of Aristotle's thought was heretical. You see,
In other words, what you're saying, in case people didn't follow that, is that the church, which was the power broker on how people thought in the Western world,
right,
went back to the Greeks, merged it with their Christian or religious teaching,
right,
and said, this is reality.
Yes, absolutely.
And in other words, questioning Aristotle was the same as questioning Jesus.
Yes, yes. And of course, that's where Galileo came to suffer. And 100 years earlier, Leonardo kept his findings secret.
For that reason.
For other reasons too, but also largely for that reason. And unfortunately, his voluminous notebooks, 13,000 pages when he died, were lost and hidden for centuries and were not really analyzed until the 19th century. This is why Leonardo had no direct influence on science.
What you're saying is he preceded it,
yeah,
but didn't inform it.
But there is a sort of a virtual lineage from Leonardo da Vinci to Johann Wolfgang von Goethe in Germany, the poet and scientist, to Gregory Bateson, the cyberneticist and systems theorist, to Prigogine, Maturana, Varela, all the people that I have written about, Lynn Margulis, the Gaia hypothesis, Gaia theory. All this is a lineage of which Leonardo stands at the beginning.
Now that's an interesting phenomenon, and let me ask you what you say about that. The fact that he preceded it, in his one self, in his one mind, in his one approach, could see it and practice it, and yet because it wasn't looked at, so what happens when something like, in other words, I'm saying there's the seed, but the seed did not lead to this.
His discoveries were rediscovered independently some 200 years later, some 300 years later, some even only in the 20th century. His anatomy of the heart contains details that people are now verifying with computer models. I mean, absolutely incredible.
You said that one of the keystones, and by the way, I'm speaking with Fritjof Capra about his new book, The Science of Leonardo. Fritjof is the author over the years of The Tao of Physics and The Turning Point and so on. His method, you said, was empirical.
Yes.
And so how does he...
Was
it cadavers or was it imagination?
No. It was experiments, observations in botany, in geology, in the science that is now called fluid dynamics or hydrodynamics, which he was the first to really create. In many, many fields, it was empirical and it was systematic scientific thinking. But the big thing that other authors have not realized before is that he must be compared to Galileo in terms of method, but not in terms of content. Because Leonardo's science was not mechanistic. It was a science of life. It was a science of systemic thought, a science of living forms that were always transforming themselves, always in development, very much like our systems and complexity theories today.
And were there others through the years who saw things that way, or was he...
Yes, yes. Yes, there were others. There was a whole movement called Romantic Biology in Germany. Then it moved to England. And, a whole series of biologists who focused on organic forms, on the nature of biological form. That influenced Darwin in his early work. So all this, but again, Leonardo was not a direct influence,
right,
it was rediscovered. And then the whole field of systems theory, cybernetics, and, modern studies of what is now called morphology, a term actually created in the 18th century by Goethe, the study of biological form. All these virtually are sort of in the lineage that starts with Leonardo.
Now, when he is seeing things that way, and then later people are seeing things that way, we've spoken about it a little earlier in the conversation, but the fact that the Newtonian understanding, the mechanical understanding, had such power in the world, Yes. In other words, you could build a machine and move a mountain. Yes. That gave it a power in the mind, didn't
it? Yes, but you see, there is where Leonardo is really unique. There have been other geniuses in history of humankind, but this is where Leonardo is unique because, as is well known and widely known, he was a mechanical genius. He was a inventor. He's known for his machines, right?
That's right. Much more than his science.
Than his science. And so this is a very subtle thought. He was a mechanical genius, but his worldview was not mechanistic. And in fact, very beautifully, he saw mechanics as a very noble science because, he says, nature has given mechanical instruments to animals because otherwise they couldn't move. And I'm going to study those mechanical instruments, he says. And so he studies mechanics for years and years in order to understand the movement of living bodies. So mechanics is subservient as a science to the life sciences, rather than saying living organisms are machines and therefore mechanics is at the top. It was just the opposite.
So he was a true synthesizer and a true,
yes,
had an integral
absolutely
view, which we have now waited hundreds of years,
yes, yes,
to gain some power again.
And in addition, his science was infused with the very deep ethics, a love of nature, a special compassion for animals. He always took nature as his mentor and model in his designs. So he was an eco-designer, if you wish. And this is, again, why he's so relevant for our time.
Right. You wrote a book with Stendhal Rast, and we've only got about a minute. You wrote a book with Stendhal Rast called Belonging in the Universe?
Yes.
In which you reconcile modern religion and modern science, about which this great argument going on today. It sounds like Leonardo himself kind of embodied that.
Yes, yes, absolutely. In his deep ecological awareness and his great reverence for life. That comes through his whole science.
Why would you recommend someone read this book?
Well, if you're interested in the history of Western thought, if you're interested in the Renaissance, if you're interested in the synthesis of art and science, and if you're interested in one of the greatest minds that ever lived, then read the book.
And also, it seems to me, one other thing is that you can see someone who saw what is so before the cloud of that mechanical worldview covered it. And maybe for even us, it's a way
absolutely
to see the whole in a way we haven't before.
Yes.
So again, the book is The Science of Leonardo. The earlier books, which I highly recommend as well, include The Tao of Physics, The Turning Point, and The Web of Life. The website is FritjofCapra.net. That's FritjofCapra.net. Thank you, Fritjof Capra, and keep up the good work.
It was a pleasure.
It really was. Thanks a lot.
This is Terrence McNally. Stay tuned for the second half, and my guest will be Nora Bateson, directed the documentary An Ecology of Mind about her father, the late Gregory Bateson. This interview originally aired July 2012.
Well, here's a quote. The major problems in the world are the result of the difference between how nature works and the way people think. And those are the words of the great and late Gregory Bateson, and I couldn't agree more. In the next half of the show, I'm going to be joined by Nora Bateson to talk about the documentary An Ecology of Mind, subtitled A Daughter's Portrait of Gregory Bateson. It tells us about the unique anthropologist, philosopher, author, naturalist, systems theorist, who I believe was ahead of his time in seeing that reality is made up not of things or even of ideas, but of relationships. The relationships among things, elements, ideas, movements, thoughts, you name it. It's about the relationships. And Nora's film will introduce Bateson to a new generation and remind many of us, myself included, of the impact her father had in the 60s and 70s on the way a lot of people perceive the world. As I watched the documentary, I just kept going, oh, that is the way I see things. And Bateson was one of the first people to articulate it. The film features interviews with California Governor Jerry Brown, physicist and systems theorist Fritjof Capra, Whole Earth Catalog creator Stuart Brand, and Nora's sister, the anthropologist Mary Catherine Bateson. Nora Bateson is a media producer and educator. Her work includes documentaries, multimedia productions, magazine columns, and developing curriculum for elementary and high school students. Welcome, Nora Bateson, to Freeform.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So could you talk briefly about your path to the work that you do today, not just this film, but whatever you consider your wider work, and feel free to cite mentors or turning points?
Okay. Well, that's an interesting question. Sometimes people ask me, when did I start making this film? And I think the only really honest answer that I can give to that is probably the day I was born. Because my work is really about something that I saw in my dad's work, but also that I've seen in other people's work. Some are artists, some are scientists, some are mathematicians, authors, etc. And that is that the world that we live in is an integrated system within system within systems, sort of complex and elaborate set of variables. And there are ways in which you can study that are stupefying and paralyzing, and ways in which you can engage and study it that are inspiring and beautiful. So I'm shooting for the latter because I've certainly been around enough of the former to know that it doesn't get you anywhere. And my work is based in storytelling, certainly. I started off in photography in college and eventually started wanting my pictures to move and to tell stories, and then I realized that there's a word for that. That's film. So I moved to filmmaking, and one of the reasons that I moved into filmmaking and the arts was that I really couldn't get any anonymity anywhere else. My father's work touched a lot of different disciplines, and because of that, whenever I entered them as a beginning student, you know, intro to psychology, intro to anthropology, intro to any number of things, I felt I wasn't really given permission to be at the beginning, that his name preceded me and that there wasn't space for me to find my own path. And
to some extent, let me cut in for a second, Nora Bates.
Yeah.
And it's interesting as you're saying that, of course, I'm thinking, and the project we're talking about is about your father. So there obviously is an arc of story for Nora Bateson here between having to get out from the shadow of to be a beginner, and then at some point saying, you know what? I'm at that point where I can devote my work to my father and not worry about that.
You know, and that's the interesting question right there. Because it was a task, and it was an enormous, not only personal achievement, but also an incredible education for me. And what happened was that after this period of rebellion, which I really unsuccessfully endeavored, right? I thought I was going to rebel by studying film, and then when I graduated college, I found myself in Southeast Asia making documentary films, which is exactly where my dad started.
That's right. And for people who don't know that, he, as a young anthropologist, joined Margaret Mead. Did they know each other when they ended up in the Far East?
They actually met in New Guinea.
They met in New Guinea and worked together, eventually married, eventually unmarried. But their work together was a really important step for both of them.
And it was some of the pioneer documentary work that was ever done in Southeast Asia. So then I realized, oh, I guess I'm a salmon. I've completely followed my own roots right back upstream where I came from. And still I rebelled. And then several years later, my sister said to me, you know, we need some audiovisual on Daddy because there's this centennial, and would you be willing to do something? And I innocently said, sure, thinking I could just knock it together, pull a couple of videos of lectures and just find something that worked. And what happened was when I did that, I found that the material was not only wonderfully interesting and rich, but also really relevant. And I was already a filmmaker, and I thought, okay, well, this is the film I have to make. And And then I found that I was in this strange thing that we call a lineage. And was I then going to carry the torch? Was I going to be the next in line to carry the mantle of my dad's work? And you know what I found out about that, which is an interesting metaphor for evolution, is that this word lineage is a misnomer because that process is not actually linear.
Mm-hmm.
And that evolution itself has to do with the context and the way in which information and relationships and communication develops between people, between organisms, within an environment. And that it isn't actually about the individual. So the story that I'm telling about my father is my story. And the way in which I portray him is an evolution to the way that he portrayed himself, if that makes any sense. The reflection is part of the context of today's rhetoric in today's world from younger generation looking back at the older generation, but through my eyes, through my lens, if you will.
Yeah, there's a quote that I have of yours, which I have made an ecology of mine to illuminate the dynamic interrelationships of life at all levels, global politics, biology, communication, evolution, and culture, told through the relationship between father and daughter. And one thing you talk about your father was that he was he excelled at zooming in and zooming out, which as a filmmaker is an interesting metaphor, but that he could from one moment see the tiniest interaction between an insect and a plant, and in the next moment, you know, the city around it and so on. And so obviously what you're talking about, global politics and the relationship between father and daughter, zooming in and zooming out. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Nora Bateson about the wonderful documentary, An Ecology of Mind, that she's made about her father, the late Gregory Bateson. And you can learn more at An Ecology of Mind, A-N-E-C-O-L-O-G-Y, An Ecology of Mind, one word, .com. And what I'd like to do right now, Nora, is play the trailer for the film. And that will give people just a little taste of it. It lasts a little over 2 minutes, listeners. You will hear several voices, and this is who you'll hear. You'll hear Nora Bateson, Governor Jerry Brown, Fritjof Capra, Stuart Brand, Mary Catherine Bateson, Nora's older sister, and finally, the last voice will be Gregory Bateson himself.
He was always learning from everyone and everything around him. As a child, I learned from him that learning never stops.
Gregory Bateson challenged us to rethink or to stand back and try to perceive in a different way, to see how reality is actually operating.
He was interested in larger patterns. He was interested in how things are connected, and especially how living things are connected.
Gregory said, "The major problems in the world are the result of the difference between how nature works and the way people think. What does it even mean to change the way we think?"
And he asked the question, what is there about our way of perceiving that makes us not see the delicate interdependencies in an ecological system that give it its integrity? We don't see them, and therefore we break them.
You have a system, and when you poke it here instead of something happening there, it happens that way, or in a barely recognizable dimension. And that's because it's a very complex system.
The nature of the world in which I live and in which I wish you lived, all of you, and all the time, but even I don't live in it all the time. There are times when I catch myself believing that there is such a thing as something which is separate from something else.
Okay, so that is the trailer to the documentary, An Ecology of Mind, A Daughter's Portrait, of Gregory Bateson. Nora, how can people get this DVD?
The DVD is mostly available right now for institutional use through Bullfrog Films, and that means that you can buy an expensive copy to show in group formats for classes and things like that. And it'll be available to the general public later on. But I don't think it's in the too distant future.
So Bullfrog Films is the distributor, and if they want to stay abreast of when it might be more widely available, they could also go to anecologyofmind.com.
That's right. And the Facebook site also, which is just An Ecology of Mind, is another probably more useful version, because it's easier for me to get the information up there. And so that's generally the most current.
Because it's easier for you to update, right?
That's right.
Right. Okay. So, and that would just be An Ecology of Mind in Facebook, right?
That's right.
Okay. Very good. Anything you want to say about what we just heard in the trailer?
I guess I would love to go. The other is one thing, and I love what my sister says in that about how the world is made of delicate interdependencies that we don't see. And because we don't see them, we tend to break them. And I think that's a really important and generous statement. It gives us a little bit of room to grow into and to say, well, okay, now how can we begin to look at those interdependencies? How can we begin to have that be part of our perception when so much of our cultural understanding and the seductiveness of linear causality in our education and everything else pushes us to see not the relationships or the communication within the relationships, but instead the things. One of the examples in the film is to look at your hand and to notice that you've been trained to see five fingers, when in fact what's important in the biological framework of that is that there are four spaces that articulate what the possibilities of those four fingers actually are. Otherwise, if you put them all together, you have a paddle, right?
Yeah, yeah. Or that whole thing about the opposable thumb, right?
That's right.
If you're just counting digits, that opposable doesn't matter.
That's right. And it becomes about, you know, in all forms of life, whether you're talking about a pond or a school or a nation or even our geopolitical system, what you're really talking about is the interrelationships that hold it together.
Yeah.
Interrelationships actually define whatever the things are, whether they're people or, you know, trees in a rainforest or insects or different kinds of algae in a pond. They're in an interrelationship, and that's what gives it its integrity. And so how can we learn to see that integrity so we don't squash it?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the one note I took while listening to the trailer was exactly that quote, your sister's quote, because as you say, and I want to go back to one thing you said, which you said it was, did you say forgiving?
Generous.
And what I think you meant was that it's not because we are evil that we make some of these mistakes. It's that our perception, for whatever reasons, as so much influenced by culture, focuses on the separate things rather than the intangible, invisible, but so influential relationships.
Right, which means that to move through to another level of being able to perceive, we don't have to first deal with the fact that we're evil, because
right.
We're not.
Right, right.
Which I know that sounds trivial, but actually it's a huge step to be benevolent to begin with and just sort of work toward another level of perception.
Yeah, there's a great quote which is in the film by your father, in which he points out that the world of separate disciplines and fields of study in which one is tested on true or false quizzes has nothing to do with the way the world actually is. And as we know, academia government policy, all of these sorts of things, tries so much to handle reality through separation and silos and analysis, which, as it turns out, are crude and often unhelpful tools for seamless existence. Now, is that one of the reasons, and I assume it is, that your father studied and worked in so many different fields?
It is exactly that. And I think it's really relevant right now. I've been traveling with this film for the last year in all parts of the world. And interestingly, all the different groups of people who have been influenced by his work have sort of in one pocket or another brought me in to do talks or seminars. And what I've found as I've gone from designers in Berlin, anthropologists in Brazil, to actually Sardinian architects in Glasgow, that was a good one, family therapists in Rome, etc., is that the silos that you were talking about a second ago, those silos are full. That in each discipline, what I'm seeing is, as this sort of privileged tour, as an interloper through all these different disciplines, which really most people don't get to do. It's been an incredible opportunity for me. Is that they're full, that everyone is wondering how to bring their discipline, their field of knowledge to the next level. And the next level is really about integration. It's about the fact that you can't look at ecology without looking at culture and psychology and education and the way that food is grown and the way, you know, there is no place that you can look that is not connected to everything, that isn't in relationship, and that integrity isn't there in the relationship. And so the question of where do we go from here, I think, really starts with how do we start to generate rhetoric and context for studying and sharing ideas in an integrated way, because our disciplines are blocked from each other, and they just are.
Yeah, in other words, people build higher and higher towers, or they burrow deeper and deeper into a field, but in fact there's an initial error at the beginning of those journeys.
Exactly.
Which means no matter how far you go and how good you are at it, if you are staying in that adopted reality of separation, you're not in sync with what you're actually trying to deal with.
That's right, and that's where that quote comes from that you began with, which is the major problems in the world are the difference between the way nature works and the way people think.
And I mean that to me is the you know, if there were a bumper sticker for all of what I've learned in preparing for this interview and going back and looking at the documentary and rereading some of Gregory Bateson, it's that one. And as you were talking, I was thinking biomimicry, which is beginning to blossom and grow as a field of design, as a field of exploration. If you're not aware of it, I did a show a few weeks ago on the Wyss Institute for Biologically Inspired Engineering at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're not aware of it, check it out. It's WYSS. What is remarkable about it is, one, that they are doing biologically inspired engineering. They are looking at what nature does and then seeing how could we do that as well. But the other thing is, the largest single gift to Harvard was to set up this institute. I like that. And mm-hmm. Second, that in the formation of it, it is the biology department, the engineering department, the design department, the business school, the economics department. It is the most interdisciplinary, and brought in actually a lot of young corporate startup types as well, because the notion was, let's get what we're doing and get it out there. To me, that the most, you know, established academic institution in this country, at least Harvard, is doing that is a good sign.
I think that is a good sign, and I think it's, you know, the thing is that while we learn to, if you will, apprentice from nature, which is I think a term that comes from Schumacher, that there's something else at hand, which is to be careful that we don't just use that knowledge to further our sort of consumer habits.
Exactly. Because that would be missing the deeper lesson of nature.
That's right.
Which is that
there
is no waste, which is everything exists in relationship to other things, and that there is no such thing as side effects. Everything is a consequence of the way things are interdependent.
And if things are interdependent and in interrelationship, what does it actually mean to own something? And I think that's a really important question because, you know, we get into objectification. And, you know, really what that is looking at things as objects, which is the opposite of looking at the relationships and the kind of communication that takes place in those relationships.
Yeah.
The thing about objectification is it's just one teeny tiny step away from exploitation.
Ah, very good. You do have a quote there from, and we're going to have to close this, but you have, when Jerry Brown is speaking, he talks about, we now find ourselves in a situation of social inequality. The proposed solution is to grow the economy. However, the result of growing the economy is more inequality. The rich get richer. Somehow we must break out of the level of consciousness that contains this contradiction. I again find it good that someone who actually holds an influential position, such as governor of California, is willing to think that way. But I think we are at the beginning or the early chapters of this new discovery that your father, this new way of seeing the world and interacting with it, that your father, I think, was one of the initial explorers. We've got to bring the conversation to a close. And the film, again, is An Ecology of Mind about the late Gregory Bateson. To learn more, go to anecologyofmind.com or go to An Ecology of Mind on Facebook. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others anytime during the week by linking to the podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly for podcasts, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of this world that just might work. Go to terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcnally, TerrenceMcNally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement of upcoming guests and issues and usually two or three articles of background, you can sign up at my site or by emailing me at TEMcNally@Mac.com, TEMcnally@Mac.com. You can also get the podcast and sign up for the podcast at iTunes. Thanks to GMA engineer Stan Mizrahi and Mark Maxwell in production, Matt Perez in traffic, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.
Tom Hartman here on the best of the rest of economic and labor news. You need to know this. You may be surprised to learn that we spend about $2 billion every year running our dysfunctional Congress. However, it's even more surprising to learn that corporate lobbyists spend even more than that to buy off our federal lawmakers. According to a recent article by Ezra Klein over at Vox.com, corporations outspend U.S. taxpayers by more than $500 million. Yet some people actually wonder why Congress is so beholden to their corporate masters. The money we pay as taxpayers funds lawmakers' salaries, their staff, and the Congressional Budget Office, the Congressional Research Service, which are two agencies responsible for educating our lawmakers about the bills they vote on. When corporations want Congress to vote in their favor, they do much more than just contribute to a lawmaker's next election. Lobbyists also use stockpiles of corporate cash to pay pro-business think tanks to generate billionaire-friendly studies. Then they use those industry-funded studies to convince members of Congress to vote in the best interest of the corporations rather than in the best interest of working Americans. Although Congress has agencies to conduct research, there's no way that the CBO or CRS can compete with billion-dollar industries. To make matters worse, Congress people don't only have to resist the corporate money. They often have to resist the influence of their former colleagues and staffers. Corporate lobbying firms scoop up nearly every retired lawmaker and well-connected staffer they can get their hands on, and they pay them far more than the taxpayers ever could. For the first time in our history, getting elected to Congress is more about the lobbying job of the future than it is about governing our country. It's time to end the revolving door between Congress and lobbying firms and to get the corporate influence out of our nation's capital. Let's keep up the fight to get money out and take our democracy back. If Indiana can let people use the so-called religious freedom laws to discriminate, or even the concept of religious freedom, one woman in Texas says she can use a similar law to feed the homeless. For the last decade, Joan Cheever of San Antonio has been serving meals to homeless people. However, that didn't stop police officers from writing her a $2,000 ticket for serving food without a permit. Unlike those who want to claim their religion gives them the right to hate others, Ms. Cheevers says that the Texas Religious Freedom Restoration Act gives her the right to care for the homeless as part of her religion. And you can certainly find plenty of religious teachings about caring for those in need. All over our country, states and municipalities have criminalized homelessness and punished those who try to help people who live on the street. From Florida fining a couple $600 for feeding the homeless, to various cities making it a crime to sit or lay down in public, there's been an all-out attack on the homeless in our nation. Now more than ever, the compassionate work of people like Joan Cheever should be celebrated, not banned. And if we happen to find a positive use for these right-to-discriminate laws, well, that's just an extra bonus. It's not often that U.S. senators stand up to big business, but when they do, they usually have help from Senator Elizabeth Warren. Last week, Senator Warren and five of her colleagues sent a letter to the FCC asking that agency to reject the proposed Comcast-Time Warner merger deal. Days later, it was announced that the deal was being scrapped if the $45.2 billion merger was allowed to go through. One company would have controlled 57% of all broadband internet and 30% of cable television service for the entire country. That also would have meant that one massive company would have controlled news and information for a very large portion of the United States. The resulting company would have also been so large that the Justice Department was looking into antitrust prohibitions. Together with Senators Al Franken, Bernie Sanders, Ron Wyden, Richard Blumenthal, and Ed Markey, Senator Warren should be applauded for standing up to this media giant and helping stop the Comcast-Time Warner merger. Austerity is harming more than just our economy. According to an open letter from 400 mental health experts, budget cuts are extremely harmful to the psychological well-being and overall quality of life of those impacted by austerity. Although the letter focused on the harmful effects of budget cuts in Britain, the warning has broader implications for all nations that have pursued austerity. The experts wrote, "The past 5 years have seen a radical shift in the kinds of issues generating distress in our clients, increasing inequality and outright poverty, and families forced to move against their wishes." They added, "Perhaps the most important, benefits claimants, including the disabled and ill people, and those seeking work are being subjected to a quite new intimidatory kind of disciplinary regime," end of quote. If these problems don't sound familiar, you haven't been paying attention, regardless of which country we're talking about. The effects are the same, and that's exactly why we needed to put an end to austerity once and for all. And finally, progressive federal lawmakers aren't the only ones fighting for working Americans. Last week, the Connecticut State Legislature advanced a bill that would make it harder for big business to skimp on workers' wages. The measure would fine large non-union companies that pay workers less than $15 an hour. As expected, Republicans in that state criticized the bill as being anti-business, but Connecticut Democrats said that they need to worry about more than just being business-friendly. State Senator Edwin A. Gomes said, "I think it's time to be employee-friendly." In addition to generating about $300 million a year for the state of Connecticut to offset corporate welfare in the form of food stamps, housing assistance, and Medicaid paid to low-wage employees, this bill could entice big companies to raise wages. Large Connecticut employers have the option of paying more to the state or to their workers. Either way, it could be a big win for the state of Connecticut. And that's the way it is for the week of April 27th, 2015. I'm Tom Hartman on the Economic and Labor News.
Here's what's happening on the Leslie Marshall Show on the Progressive Voices Network. They think that there weren't Democrats and liberals in power in Baltimore and Maryland and in the White House, this riot wouldn't have happened. And that, I think we would all agree, is completely ignorant, naive, that this is not about politics. This is about anger. This is about a lack of justice. This is about a perception. This is about some reality. This is about the need for change. This morning, my kids had a spring concert, and I sat next to a woman who is African-American, and I said to her, "What do you think of Baltimore as a black woman?" And she said, "Look, I think it's wrong. I don't condone violence." But she said, "You know, there is anger. And when you add anger to the lack of opportunity, lack of educational opportunity, work opportunity, African-Americans in the inner city do not have the same opportunity as those of us who are are not black and those of us who do not live in the inner city. That is not about race. That is not about Al Sharpton. That, my friend, is about truth. The Leslie Marshall Show, Monday to Friday from 3 to 6 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Voices Network. 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 Progressive